Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with the Week in Review for Saturday, December 19th. I'm going to limit my comments on the economy as much as possible since I'll have my year-end stem winder on January 2nd, at which time I'll unveil the forecast for 2010. But for now, the economic news was solid this week with November industrial production up 0.8%, better than expected, along with solid readings for the leading economic indicators benchmark, as well as November housing starts up 8.9%. The Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee met for the final time of the year and reiterated yet again that economic activity is likely to remain weak, inflation subdued, and the Fed is going to keep interest rates near zero for an extended period of time. It's still all about a weak labor market and tight credit. And as a big storm threatens a large segment of the U.S. population this last shopping weekend before Christmas, it's a lock. Retail sales will be down or flat at best versus last year's desultory performance. The Wall Street Journal's Gerald Seib nailed it in his column on Friday when he spoke of the general lack of confidence on the part of the American public these days. Whereas there was a burst of optimism around mid-year when we realized we weren't falling off a cliff, today there is a deep-seated unease that will not go away anytime soon. It's best spelled out in a journal poll this week that showed 2 in 3 do not believe the next generation will be better off than today's. Without giving away all my thoughts on 2010, this is an important item for me, and I'll just add for now that due to geopolitical reasons, there will come a time next year when we'll feel about as low as you can get. There was some good news on the corporate front in the here and now, though. While guiding earnings lower, Bellwether Federal Express nonetheless expressed optimism the U.S. economy had reached a turning point in the current quarter, and tech heavyweights Oracle and Research in Motion reported solid earnings and revenues. But global equity markets were generally flat on the week amid concerns about sovereign debt, especially in Europe, and more specifically the likes of Greece and Spain, along with fellow pigs, Portugal, Italy, and Ireland. It does beg the question, how will the European Union handle this? Do they, as Germany suggests, bail out their brethren? There's nothing in the charter that spells out how to do this. Imagine the precedent it would set. In the meantime, the euro currency was taken out back and shot, which of course is good for European exporters, conversely, while the beaten down U.S. dollar rallied big, once again perceived as a safe haven. No surprise from yours truly, seeing as I haven't been concerned about the dollar for ages. What you have in Europe, though, is a classic case of the haves versus the have-nots, north versus south, save for the still-struggling Baltics. A few other thoughts before I get to bigger topics. Leading economist Martin Feldstein said the recession isn't over. It'll be a while before we have enough information to know if it ended. Feldstein being a member of the NBER's Business Cycle Dating Committee that decides when recessions start and end. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said, "We have a level of employment which is barely adequate to staff the level of output. It seems to me virtually inevitable that employment would start to come back fairly quickly." Abu Dhabi came to the temporary rescue of Dubai World in providing $10 billion to pay off some of its debts, including $4.1 billion due bondholders and select contractors last Monday. Though it's not known to what extent Abu Dhabi and other Emirates may step up in the future, or whether or not they view Dubai World as their responsibility. The debt had been originally sold with a kind of implicit guarantee of government support, and Monday's action only reinforced this. On the issue of health care legislation and the looming Christmas recess, it would appear the fate of the Senate bill rests in the hands of Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska in order for there to be a filibuster-proof 60 votes. But the Senate bill hardly resembles what President Obama laid out during his campaign and is far from universal coverage, let alone having a public option, a government-run health insurance alternative. Republican Senator Olympia Snowe, who could still climb aboard but only down the road, said the current timetable is, quote, totally unrealistic, and looking for a vote by Christmas. Importantly, many in President Obama's own base are none too happy. Rich Lowry, New York Post, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid can rightly claim to be making history. If he passes health care reform, he'll depend on a series of historic firsts. It'd be the first time Congress had passed a major new entitlement program without bipartisan support. It'd be the first time it passed such a program without popular support, and the first time it passed such a program without knowing or particularly caring what's in it. John McCain complained last week that he had no idea what constituted the highly touted backroom deal that Reid sent to the Congressional Budget Office for evaluation. Number two Senate Democrat, Dick Durbin, reassured McCain that he didn't know either. This is bipartisanship, Harry Reid style, non-transparency for everyone. That was Rich Lowry. Among the hidden proposals is giving the uninsured aged 55 to 64 entree into Medicare, long reserved for 65 and older. For this reason alone, a momentous change, the bill should be shelved until January so that there can be a full debate. It's astounding Reid seeks no such thing. Michael Gerson, Washington Post. Democratic health reform legislation promises everything to everyone while imposing a series of hidden burdens to make a massive new entitlement affordable, at least on paper. So its authors are in a game of beat the clock, pass the legislation before those burdens are fully disclosed to the public. The entire Democratic health reform effort is foundering as its deep bow enters the shallow channel of fiscal reality, and that splash you hear is the sound of various groups being thrown from the ship to lighten the load. That was Michael Gerson. Then there's Copenhagen and the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. Today, according to Washington Post ABC News poll, only 45% approve of President Obama's handling of the global warming issue. 4 in 10 also place little trust in what scientists have to say about the environment, which is why, I repeat, this whole issue has been framed improperly. It's about global pollution, including clean water. But in a USA Today Gallup survey, if the question is asked whether you want a specific treaty limiting greenhouse gases, by a 55-38 margin, Americans support this. However, by a 7-1 margin, we want the administration to focus instead on improving the economy. Editorial, Washington Post. The Copenhagen Climate Conference was supposed to produce a landmark accord on climate change. It won't. Hopes for a binding treaty died weeks before the meeting, and with some observers terming the proceedings constipagan, it's all too easy to wonder whether the conferees will even be able to conclude a less ambitious political agreement. The big fissures generally lie between rich and poor. Developing nations variously want rich countries to commit to emissions cuts on the order of 25 to 40% of 1990 levels by 2020, to provide at least $100 billion a year by 2020, to help poorer countries adapt to climate change, curb deforestation, and decrease the carbon intensity of their development. Developed countries appear ready to provide about $10 billion annually for the next few years to help poor nations adapt to climate change, but they shouldn't commit to much more without some critical concessions, particularly from the big emitters that will account for so much future emissions growth, notably China. So that was an editorial in the Washington Post a couple days ago. Regarding China, the deal is they'll agree to targets and have already committed to achieving big cuts, but they don't want anyone looking over their shoulders. Of course, it's not as if President Obama can jack them up against the wall, something about massive amounts of U.S. debt that they own, you understand. And so, late Friday, a non-binding agreement was announced between the U.S., China, India, Brazil, and South Africa that President Obama had to admit was hardly enough to prevent global warming. "We have much further to go," he said. As in, there were no emissions targets, after all, and transparency is virtually non-existent, it would seem. Not that I really care, mind you, it's just all a farce, and a real humiliation for the likes of Obama and British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. What might be of significance down the road is that it was apparently a real tension convention between the U.S. and China on Friday, and that's not necessarily good. Far more next week as further details emerge. Lastly, Iran, which remains a potential game-changer. Israel's Chief of Military Intelligence, Major General Amos Yadlin, in rare public comments said Iran was nearing a breakthrough and that there is enough enriched uranium at Natanz for a bomb, though it needs to be enriched further. Bottom line, the nuclear technology clock, quote, has almost finished ticking. Earlier, the London Times reported that Iran is working on a neutron initiator, a key final component of a nuclear weapon. Well, for its part, Iran tested a long-range missile with a supposed range of 2,000 kilometers or 1,240 miles, giving it an ability to hit Israel. Tehran also laid out a bogus plan to exchange uranium for nuclear fuel, but only in stages, which leaves Iran in control of enough material to make a bomb. Friday night, President Ahmadinejad said he was prepared to reach an agreement on nuclear fuel, quote, but not in a climate where the U.S. and Western powers threaten us. Iran's leadership also claimed the opposition, which demonstrated anew in large numbers, tore up a picture of Ayatollah Khomeini, giving the Revolutionary Guard and its thugs, such as the Basiji, an excuse for a further crackdown. But opposition leaders said the whole incident was trumped up and images fabricated so that they could be used as a pretext for a new wave of repression. Defense Secretary Robert Gates reiterated that while he won't take any options off the table, the reality is that any military action will only buy some time, maybe 2 or 3 years. Of course, this is what you'd expect them to say. Israel would be happy to know it bought 2 years. That gives them and the forces of good around the world 2 years to work on a bomb plot that takes out Iran's leadership during one of those Friday prayer sessions. I'm only half kidding. A cruise missile would also do the trick. It would kill too many civilians. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak stated the obvious when he said that Egypt or Turkey or Saudi Arabia can hardly afford not being nuclear if Iran turns nuclear. But it constantly needs to be said. Barak also noted there should be a time limit for all these attempts to block Iran through sanctions. There are some in Israel who say they will wait until the end of 2010, deferring to United States and international diplomacy. I can't possibly fathom that. Daniel Pletka, Washington Post. Iran is proceeding with an aggressive nuclear weapons program, and a few dogged holdouts notwithstanding, much of the Obama administration has come to terms with that reality. Official Washington has resigned itself to pursuing a containment policy that some argue will limit Iran's ability to proliferate, terrorize, and otherwise exploit being a nuclear power. But it's wrong to think a nuclear Iran can be contained. Advocates of containment and deterrence suggest that Iran will be encircled by a like-minded group of nations bent on raising the cost of adventurism. This absurd notion rests on weak reeds in Europe, and Arabs deeply hesitant to act. Worse, the common notion of deterrence is ill-designed for the regime in Tehran. Perhaps it is unfair to suggest that today's Iranian leadership is fashioned from different cloth than the Soviets. After all, we are often reminded that the doctrine of mutually assured destruction worked with the Soviet Union for half a century, but even the most ardent hawks have serious doubts about the U.S. resolve to, quote, totally obliterate, close quote, Iran in the event of a nuclear attack on, say, Israel, despite Hillary Clinton's threat as a presidential candidate to do just that. Many also scoff at the notion that a responsible Iranian leader would risk using or transferring nuclear weapons or technology. We are told that Ahmadinejad, who most acknowledge is crazy enough to use such a weapon, won't make the final decision, but the regime is remarkably opaque, and shifting power centers ensure that even capable intelligence agencies have low levels of certainty about decision-making in Iran's nuclear program. If our intelligence community's prognostications about Iran's reaction to the Obama engagement policy are any indication, apparently they predicted that Iran was desperate to talk, then it seems safe to conclude that no one knows whose finger will be on Iran's nuclear trigger. Daniel Pletka continues, privately, Obama administration officials confess that they believe Israeli action will preempt our policy debate, as Israel's tolerance for an Iranian nuke is significantly lower than our own. But subcontracting American national security to Israel is an appalling notion, and we cannot assume that an Israeli action would not provoke a wider regional conflict into which the United States would be drawn. After a year of false starts and failed initiatives, the Obama administration should be pressed to find a new way forward. At the very least, we must hope the president's new policy will not find footing in the false notion that a nuclear Iran can be contained. This is Daniel Pletka, Washington Post. But it would appear the White House is indeed content to let Israel act. Haaretz is reporting that when President Obama met with Chinese President Hu Jintao last month, he warned Hu that the U.S. cannot indefinitely prevent Israel from launching strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities if China maintains its opposition to new punitive measures. It's possible Friday's dust-up in Copenhagen between the U.S. and China makes Chinese cooperation even less likely and an Israeli strike more inevitable. Turning to Wall Street, stocks finished mixed, with the Dow Jones losing 1.4% to 10,328, and the S&P 0.4%, but NASDAQ, thanks to Oracle and Research in Motion, tacked on 1%, and the small-cap Russell 2000, 1.7%. Aside from Citigroup's dismal stock sale, Meredith Whitney's earnings cuts for some of the leading financials didn't help matters. I'll be back with you at some time, probably not the morning of December 26th, but later on the 26th. In the meantime, have a great week and Merry Christmas to all. I appreciate your support.